10. The Rosicrucians. Nergin made his way up the broad, red-carpeted stairway, deserted at this hour, with bronze candlesticks and an ornate stucco ceiling overhead, to the third floor. Trying to look carefree, he strolled past the desk of the free employee, manning the outside telephones, and knocked at the door of the director of research, MGB engineer Colonel Anton Nikolaevich Yakonov. The office was spacious, carpeted wall to wall, and furnished with armchairs and sofas. The azure patch in the middle was the dazzling cloth on a long conference table, contrasting with the brownness of Yakonov's elegant desk and armchair in the far corner. Nergin had viewed this magnificence before, but not very often, and usually not alone, but in group discussions. Engineer Colonel Yakonov was over 50, but still in his prime. His stature, the hint of powder on his face after shaving, his gold-rimmed pince-nez, his soft, princely plumpness, an Obolensky or a Dolgoruki, his majestic, self-assured movements, made him a conspicuous figure among the grandees of his ministry.
"Take a seat, Gleb Vikintich."
An expansive wave accompanied the invitation. He sat hunched in his outsized armchair, twiddling a fat-coloured pencil over the polished brown desktop. Addressing him by his first name and patronymic was a mark of courtesy and goodwill that cost the engineer-colonel no effort, since he had a list of all the prisoners, with their full names, under a glass on his desk. Those unaware of this were amazed at Yakonov's memory. Nergin bowed silently. He did not hold his hands along the seams of his trousers, but did not wave them about either. He sat down expectantly at the imposing, highly polished desk. Yakonov's voice was a rich rumble. It always seemed strange that this fine gentleman did not cultivate an exquisite lisp.
"Do you know, Gleb Vikintich, I happened to think of you half an hour ago, and I started wondering what wind exactly had blown you into the acoustics lab to, Reitman."
Yakonov pronounced this name with undisguised contempt, and in the presence of Reitman's subordinate didn't even prefix it with the word major. Relations between the head of the research institute and his senior deputy had deteriorated so far that there was no longer any point in concealing it. Nergin tensed. Instinct told him that the conversation was off to a bad start. It was with the same contemptuous and ironical curve of his not exactly thin and not exactly thick lips that Yakonov had told Nergin some days back that he, Nergin, was perhaps objective about the results of the voice tests, but that he treated number 7 not like a dear departed relative, but like an unidentified drunk found dead under the Marfino fence. Number 7 was Yakonov's hobby horse, but it was going very badly.
"I, of course, greatly appreciate your personal contribution to the science of voice classification."
He was being sarcastic.
"And I'm dreadfully sorry that your original monograph was printed only in a small classified edition, which denied you the fame of a sort of Russian George Fletcher."
Brutally sarcastic.
"But I should still like to see a little more profit, as the Anglo-Saxons put it, from your activities. I pay homage to the abstract sciences, but I am a practical man."
Engineer Colonel Yakonov had risen high enough, yet was still at a sufficient distance from the leader of the peoples to permit himself the luxury of not disguising his cleverness or refraining from idiosyncratic pronouncements.
"Well now, let me ask you frankly, what is going on right now in the acoustics lab?"
The most ruthless question imaginable. Yakonov simply didn't have time to keep up with everything, or he would have gotten their number long ago.
"Why the devil do you waste your time on that gibberish? Stir, smear. You're a mathematician, aren't you? A university man. Look behind you."
Nergin looked and rose from his chair. There were 3 of them in the office, not 2. An unremarkable man in dark civilian clothes rose from a sofa to face him. His round spectacles flashed as he moved his head. In the lavish light from overhead, Nergin recognized Pyotr Trofimovich Verenev, a senior lecturer in his university before the war. But, true to his prison training, he remained silent and made no movement, assuming that the man before him was a prisoner and fearing to compromise him by premature recognition. Verenyev smiled, but also looked embarrassed. Yakonov rumbled reassuringly.
I must say this ritual restraint is one of the things I envy about the mathematical fraternity. All my life I've thought of mathematicians as a sort of Rosicrucian brotherhood, and I've always regretted that it was never my luck to be initiated into their mysteries. Don't be shy. Shake hands and make yourselves comfortable. I shall leave you for half an hour. You can exchange fond memories, and Professor Verenyev can explain the tasks that the Sixth Administration has set us. With this, Yakonov lifted himself out of his oversized chair and made light work of carrying his far-from-light frame, made more imposing by his silver and blue epaulettes, to the exit. When Nerzhin's hand met Verenyev's, they were alone. To Nerzhin, set as he was in his prison ways, this pale man in the twinkling glasses was like a ghost unlawfully returning from a forgotten world, separated from today's world by the forests around Lake Ilmien, the hills and ravines of the Aryol region, the sands and marshes of Belorussia, prosperous Polish farms, the tiled roofs of little German towns. Other memories were engraved on this nine-year interval between meetings. The bright, bare boxes and cells of the Lubyanka, the grime and stench of transit prisons, stifling compartments in prisoner transport trains, cold and hungry zeks out in the biting wind of the steppes. It was impossible to think back beyond all this and relive how it felt to see the formula for the functions of an independent variable written out on the pliant oilcloth surface of a blackboard. They lit cigarettes, Nerzhin unsteadily, and sat facing each other across a small table. It was not Verenyev's first encounter with a former student, from Moscow or from Rostov, where he had been sent before the war to draw a firm line between conflicting schools of thought. But this meeting with Nerzhin was something out of the ordinary for him, too. This establishment so near to and so remote from Moscow, shrouded in a smokescreen of super-secrecy, wound around with ring after ring of barbed wire, those unfamiliar blue overalls instead of normal human dress. The younger of the two, with the lines around his mouth more pronounced than ever, apparently had the right to ask the questions, while the older man answered as though ashamed of his modest academic career. Evacuation, return from evacuation, 3 years working with K, successful doctoral thesis on topology. Nerzhin, boorishly casual, did not even ask the subject of his contribution to this austere field of study in which he had once himself intended to choose his degree project. He suddenly felt sorry for Verenyev. Ordered magnitudes, incompletely ordered magnitudes, finite magnitudes. Topology. The stratosphere of human thought. In the 24th century it might just possibly be of use to somebody, but for the present... Why should I speak of suns and worlds? I have eyes for man suffering alone. But why had Verenyev left the university and landed in this department? Posted here, of course. But couldn't he have refused? Well, yes, he could. Only, in this job his salary was doubled. Did he have children? 4 of them. For some reason, they started going over the students who had graduated with Nerzhin. Their final examination had taken place on the day war broke out. The most gifted of them had been killed or shell-shocked. They're the ones who always stick their necks out, never look after themselves. While those of whom you would never have expected it were completing a higher degree course or held lectureships. Well, and what about the pride of the department, Dmitri Dmitrich, Goryainov Shakhovskoy? A little old man, so very old that he had become slovenly in his habits. His black velvet jacket was always smothered in chalk, and he often put the blackboard duster into his pocket instead of his handkerchief. A walking anecdote, a compendium of innumerable professorial jokes, the life and soul of the Imperial University of Warsaw, which in 1915 had moved to the commercial town of Rostov as though to a graveyard. On his golden jubilee as a scientist, he was honoured with congratulatory telegrams from Milwaukee, Cape Town, Yokohama. Then, in 1930, when the university was revamped as an industrial pedagogical institute, he had been purged by a proletarian commission as a hostile bourgeois element. Nothing could have saved him, had he not known Kalinin personally.
It was said that Kalinin's father had been one of the professor's father's serfs. Whether that was so or not, Gorianov took a trip to Moscow and brought back an order to keep your hands off this man. And they did. They took such good care not to touch him that those not in the know were sometimes quite alarmed. One minute he would be writing a scientific paper with a mathematical proof of God's existence. The next, in a public lecture on his idol, Newton, the droning voice from under the yellowing moustache would announce that somebody had sent up a note saying, "According to Marx, Newton is a materialist, but you say that he is an idealist. My answer is that Marx misrepresented the facts. Newton believed in God, as all great scientists do." Recording his lectures was a nightmare. The stenographers were in despair. Because his legs were weak, he would sit right by the blackboard, facing it, with his back to his audience, writing with his right hand, erasing with his left, and mumbling to himself incessantly. It was hopeless trying to understand his ideas during a lecture. But Nyazhin and a fellow student, taking it in turns, sometimes managed to write it all down and went over it in the evening. They were awestruck, as though they were gazing into a sky filled with twinkling stars. So what had become of the old man? He had been concussed in an air raid on Rostov and evacuated half dead to Kirgizia. Then there was some story about his sons, both lecturers. Verenev didn't know the details. Some dirty business, something treasonable. Stivka, the younger one, was now a longshoreman on the New York waterfront, so they said. Nyazhin studied Verenev closely while he was talking. Strange that good scientific minds, so agile in multidimensional space, should look at life itself with tunnel vision. A thinker is insulted by thugs and louts. That is just a symptom of immaturity, a momentary lapse. If his children remember their father's humiliation, that is obscene, that is treason. And who really knew whether Stivka was actually a New York longshoreman or not? The secret police shape public opinion. What, Verenev asked, had Nyazhin done to find himself inside? Nyazhin laughed. No, really. What had he done? Thought the wrong thoughts, Pyotr Trofimovich. The Japanese have a law that a man can be put on trial for his unspoken thoughts. The Japanese? But we have no such law, do we? Oh, yes, we do. It's called 58/10. After this, Nyazhin listened with one ear, as Verenev told him Yakonov's real reason for bringing them together. The Sixth Administration had sent Verenev to intensify and systematize the work they were doing on encoding. Mathematicians were needed, lots of them, and Verenev was delighted to see among them a former student for whom he had had high hopes. Nyazhin mechanically asked for details, and Pyotr Trofimovich, in a fine mathematical frenzy, set about explaining the object of the research and detailing the experiments to be made and the formulas to be reconsidered. Nyazhin's mind, meanwhile, was on those scraps of paper which he covered with his tiny handwriting, secure and at peace behind his camouflaged defences, while Simochka stole loving glances at him and Lev good-naturedly bumbled. Those tiny pages were the first fruits of his maturity. It was preferable, of course, to reach maturity before your 30s, and in your original subject. Why, it might be asked, should he stick his head into those jaws from which historians themselves had scuttled away to ages safely over and done with? Why was he so fascinated by the riddle of the grim, inflated giant, who had only to flutter an eyelash and Nyazhin's head would fly off? Should he then surrender to the tentacles of the cryptographic octopus? For 14 hours a day they would crush him, never relaxing even during rest periods. Probability theory, number theory, the theory of error, would monopolize his thoughts. It would be brain death, desiccation of the soul. What room would there be for meditation, for trying to make sense of life? Still, this was a sharashka, not a camp. There was meat for dinner, butter in the morning. The skin on your hands was not lacerated and calloused. Your fingers weren't frostbitten. You didn't slump onto the bedplanks like an insensate log in your filthy rope sandals. No, you got into bed happily, under a clean white comforter. So what was the point of just living all your life? living for the sake of living, with no concern beyond your physical comfort. Lovely comfort. But what is the point if there is nothing more? Reason told him to agree. His heart said, "Get thee behind me, Satan." "Pyotr Trofimovitch, do you know how to make shoes?"
"What was that?"
"I mean, can you teach me to make shoes? I want to learn to make shoes."
"I'm sorry, I don't understand."
"Pyotr Trofimovitch, you live in a shell. When I've served my sentence, I will be going into the depths of the Tiger, into permanent exile. I can't do any sort of work with my hands, so how am I going to live? There are brown bears out there. Another 3 Mesozoic eras will come and go before anybody out there needs Leonhard Euler's functions."
"What are you talking about, Nierzhin? If your work as a cryptographer is successful, you will be released early. Your conviction will be annulled. You'll be given an apartment in Moscow."
"My dear Pyotr Trofimovitch, I don't want any thanks from them. I don't want their forgiveness, and I'm not interested in catching minnows for them." The door opened, and in came the great Panjandrum with the gold-rimmed pince-nez on his fleshy nose.
"How goes it, my Rosicrucian friends? All settled?"
Still seated, Nierzhin looked Yakonov straight in the eye and replied, "With respect, Anton Nikolaevich, I consider that my work in the acoustics laboratory is not yet complete." By now, Yakonov was standing behind his desk, the knuckles of his pudgy hands resting on its glass top to take his weight. Only those who knew him well would have realized from his words that he was angry.
"Mathematics and articulation. You've traded the food of the gods for a mess of pottage. You can go."
And with the two-colored lead of his fat pencil, he made a note on his memo pad.
"Write off, Nierzhin.